Hi, I'm John Harwood, your host for Bedeviled, a podcast about American democracy from the DeWitt Wallace Center for Media and Democracy at Duke University. We bring you conversations with politicians, journalists, and academics about preserving the delicate balance of our fractious system of self-government. During the first Trump presidency, Marty Baron and the newspaper he ran, The Washington Post, was a journalistic model for holding the administration to account. Baron led a brilliant team of journalists covering Trump's performance on the economy, foreign policy, and the coronavirus pandemic, among other topics. They enjoyed the backing of the Post's billionaire owner, Amazon founder Jeff Bezos. They embraced their role with the slogan, "Democracy dies in darkness." Things are different now. Baron has retired, and alumni of Rupert Murdoch's media empire are in charge. Bezos is paying homage to Trump, and as a consequence, some of the Post star reporters have fled to work elsewhere. Most recently, Bezos alarmed the newspaper's staff by taking control of its editorial pages. I spoke with Baron about Trump 2.0, the media's coverage of it, and America's path ahead. Marty Baron, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Let me start with a question that alludes back to something that you and the Washington Post were known for a few years ago when you were the editor. You had a slogan, "Democracy dies in darkness." When you look at the situation right now, is democracy dying in broad daylight?
Well, it's eroding, that's for sure. I don't know that I'm ready to declare its death by any means, but we're certainly seeing our democracy erode. There's no question about that. I think that this administration is taking measures that are weakening our pillars of a democracy.
How would you compare what you're seeing in the opening weeks of Trump 2.0 to Trump 1.0, which, of course, we lived through as journalists?
Well, I'd say in his first administration, he was really unprepared for the job and so was sort of feeling his way. And so he was acting in a fairly disorganized and chaotic way. Right now with Trump 2.0, he clearly has a plan. It really is Project 2025, even though he said he had no idea what it was or who was behind it. And he seems to be following that plan in a very disciplined way.
And how would you assess the performance of the mainstream press in covering and responding today versus 8 years ago?
Well, I mean, I think the mainstream press has done a pretty good job, actually. I realize that that runs counter to some narratives out there. But the fact is, during the first Trump administration, we regularly reported on what was happening in that administration, what was happening behind the scenes. We disclosed a ton of things that the administration did not want the public to know, starting from its very first days. I recall our reporting at the Washington Post on Trump's calls with the leaders of Mexico and Australia. And they were so apoplectic about the fact that we had disclosed that, that Trump went to his then Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, and ordered him to launch more leak investigations. And Sessions, in announcing that he would do more leak investigations, cited that story in particular. Today, well, I think we're seeing a lot of reporting about what's actually happening behind the scenes. There's been some good reporting by the major news organizations and some additional ones as well. So I think people have taken note that Wired has done a really good job of reporting on DOGE and particularly its, you know, its intrusions into people's private information. So I think we know a lot. I think this administration, well, Trump this time and his allies within the administration, his appointees, are doing are systematically trying to obstruct access to information to a degree that we didn't even see during the first term.
Well, given that, that more aggressive, you could say brazen, assault on the dissemination of accurate information, you had something you said during the first Trump administration, which was, "We're not at war, we're at work." Is that still the posture for the mainstream press?
Well, I think it's the right posture, actually. I still believe that. I think that, look, we have a mission. It was a mission essentially assigned to us by the founders of this country. You know, James Madison, in authoring, being the principal author of the First Amendment, talked about freely examining public characters and measures. And then by the word examining, he means going beneath the surface and behind the curtain, not just being stenographers. And I think that's what we have to do. Our mission as journalists is to tell the public what it needs and deserves to know, so that they can govern themselves. I think to the extent that we fall into, we take the position that we are warriors, that we are engaged in some sort of ongoing battle with the administration, that we're its opponent, then we fall into a trap that I believe this administration wants us to fall into, and that a trap that would allow them to portray us as political opponents, not as independent arbiters of fact. And I think it's very important that we not fall into that trap and that we not have that mentality. Because if you have that mentality, it can take you down a lot of bad paths. You make assumptions that you shouldn't make, and often you don't rigorously examine what the facts are, with the independence that's required, and with an open mind.
Well, how does the press respond in a more neutral way when you have brazen attempts by the administration to, let's say, punish the Associated Press for not calling the Gulf of Mexico the Gulf of America, as Trump prefers, or when you have regulators saying they're going to open or talking about opening criminal investigations, removing the licenses from news networks that edit interviews in ways that they don't like? How should the press treat itself vis-a-vis the administration when those aggressive moves are coming from them?
Sure. Well, first of all, I didn't use the word neutral. I'm not talking about false equivalence. I'm not talking about false balance. And I'm not talking about that if we do all our work and we discover the facts and we put them in context, that somehow we're supposed to hide what we actually did in the first place. The whole purpose of reporting is to get at the facts, to get at the context, and to tell the public what we've actually learned to be true, and not disguise that by pretending that there are always two sides to something when in fact there aren't. Obviously, there are a lot of different opinions about policies, but when it comes to facts, our job is to get them and to tell people what they are, and do that unflinchingly. So neutral is not the word that I would use. I say independent. And, you know, look, with regard to the AP and with regard to the FCC's efforts, or the chairman of the FCC's efforts to penalize networks for no good reason, well, we're adamantly opposed to that. I mean, as an industry, obviously, we have to be in favor of the freedom of the press. I mean, that is a pillar of our democracy. It isn't the First Amendment. It's not a special right for us. It's the same right that every person in the country has, and that is the right to free expression. And so we have to report vigorously on those efforts. I think we do have to think through, like, what are the measures that we should take that can help counter what the president is doing to obstruct the press. I think that there is likely to be litigation, which all of the press, I believe, should support, regarding the FCC's what I would consider to be absolutely unconstitutional efforts to infringe on the First Amendment rights of the networks. And I also believe the efforts by President Trump to infringe on the First Amendment rights of the Associated Press, the right to choose the terminology that it wishes to use for itself. And so I would expect there to be litigation in that regard, and I would hope the press will support collectively that kind of litigation. I also think with regard to AP, I mean, this is something that, you know, I haven't really thought it through in great depth, but I think the press should think about it. It's like, why not everybody give access to the Associated Press to all of their photographs, all of their video, all of that, anything involving the White House, all of them work collectively that way and not keep it for themselves. Just say, you know, all for one, one for all. And our work out of the White House, out of Air Force One, out of any interactions with the president are going to be collectively available to anybody who has been denied that access.
What is your view of the calls, which we hear from some quarters, for media organizations to, in response to, say, what's happening with the AP, to boycott press briefings or boycott press conferences? Is that a constructive step?
I don't think so. At least as I think about it now, I don't think it is. I think that that is probably what the White House would say. Great. We didn't want you here anyway. And so, so I don't think that that's a, I don't think that that's a great idea, but I do think that there's an opportunity to say, look, if you exclude any one of us, then, you know, our information is available from all of us. Every single one of our media outlets is available to that news organization that you're planning to exclude. All of our photos, all of our video, all of that. That doesn't solve the problem for the AP, which would like to have its own representative there, of course. But it would be, I think, a significant measure.
You mentioned a few minutes ago the fact that you are not in favor of false equivalence. Do you consider false equivalence to have been something the mainstream press was guilty of for either for a long time or in a narrower time frame? Some organizations or a lot of organizations, is that a legit problem that has contributed to the situation that the country finds itself in right now?
Well, I didn't see a lot of it, frankly. I mean, I realized that the mainstream press was accused of that regularly. But yeah, sure. Were there some examples of that? I think there were. But not as a rule. I don't think that was the case with the mainstream press. And I would also add that I hate to generalize across the press. All of us are different. All of us make our own decisions. You know, we're perhaps the only profession that people speak about in such generalities. You know, nobody says all doctors, all plumbers, all electricians, all lawyers do this or that. But when they talk about the media, they talk about it as a collective group, as if we all do the same thing. The reality is that we're all independent organizations. We all make our judgments. We often differ in our judgments and differ in our behaviors. So anyway, as a rule, I don't think that false equivalence was a huge problem, nor do I think it is the reason that Donald Trump is in office today. The reality is that his supporters, for the most part, are not reading the kind of press that you're talking about. So they don't. I mean, about a third of the American public doesn't really turn to any media outlet. They get their news, what they consider to be news, from friends and family and across the transom. They can't even identify where. And then, of course, a huge portion of Trump's followers are getting their news from Fox News and outlets like it, outlets on the far right, or across social media that affirms their pre-existing view of the world. So I don't think that anything really in the mainstream press is the reason that we have Donald Trump today. I think there are much more fundamental reasons for his presence in the White House.
In line with that comment, it's also the case that if you look at the readership or listenership of mainstream media organizations and say, well, if mainstream media did a better job, you know, more people would agree with the way they see the world. Most of our audiences already agree with the way we see the world. So that limits the potential upside for acting in a different way. Do you agree?
Well, it's true. I mean, look, I mean, the percentage of readers who go to the New York Times, who are subscribers to the New York Times or readers of the New York Times who are conservative, who consider themselves to be conservative, however they define that these days, is in the single digits. And the same is true for the Washington Post. So it's true that media consumption today is just highly polarized. I do think there are some steps we can take to improve those numbers, probably not dramatically, but significantly, I would say. I think we should think about those and try to take whatever measures we can.
What are those steps you're thinking of?
Well, for one, I think that it's true that a lot of people in this country feel that that mainstream media is completely out of touch with their lives, that we don't reflect that in our coverage. And it's true that most of mainstream media is based on the coasts. We don't have nearly enough people around the country reflecting what the struggles, the aspirations, the expectations of people who may not see the world the way we do. I'm not even just talking about politics here, but I mean just what their lives are like, what they're having to deal with, why they're so aggrieved. Look, there are a lot of people in this country who are struggling. They feel that the so-called elites, and they include the press in that, even though most of the press isn't paid like the elite, they feel that that we haven't taken the time to really understand what they're dealing with. They're struggling. They're not getting paid what they used to get paid. There aren't opportunities for their kids. As a result, there are all social problems in their communities. Now, whether they should blame the press for that is another matter, or whether they should blame the so-called elites for that is another matter. But they do, and they are struggling. And somehow they need to see that we're paying attention to them, that we're not ignoring them, that we understand what they're going through. Another thing that I think we need to do is that we just need to be way more transparent about how we go about our work, not just who we are, but show people how we did our stories. If there's a court document, show the whole court document. Don't just quote it, but you can show the entire court document. You can annotate it, say where you got it from. Same thing with an audio or a video or any data set. Take people to the original and the entire audio, video, or data set. And with the message being, check our work. You have the right, and we're giving you the opportunity to check our work. We're showing you exactly what we did and how we did it, and let us know if you think that we did something wrong. So that kind of radical transparency, I think, is incredibly important. Frankly, I think CBS, in their interview with Kamala Harris, they would have been well advised that not only air the interview, but publish the entire transcript of the interview with Kamala Harris at the very time that they aired the interview. I mean, we did that at the Washington Post when Trump visited the editorial board in 2016. He met with them. The interview was recorded. We didn't just report on what he said. We published the entire transcript of that interview word for word. And I think that sort of thing needs to be done more often. And then finally, we need to figure out how to communicate better. The reality is that even though traditional media, they are communications companies, they're failing to communicate. And we can see that in terms of how influencers are having greater success connecting with people than traditional news organizations are. And so we need to learn from that and say, what is it that they are doing that we're not doing, and how can we do better?
You mentioned a few moments ago the FCC's unjustified pursuit of news networks for investigation, and said, you know, that those things are contravening freedom of the press and we're opposed to them. Should stories say that we are opposed to them and bluntly characterize what we believe it is, as opposed to doing a little bit more of a he said, she said kind of thing? The Trump administration says X and the editor of, or the, you know, president of X network says Y.
Well, I think if you, just because you don't say we're opposed to this doesn't mean you're doing he said, she said work, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
I think one can write these stories making clear that these are unprecedented actions by the FCC. These are not the kinds of actions that have been taken by previous FCC chairmen and the commissions, and that, in fact, previous commissioners are adamantly opposed to this and see this as an infringement upon First Amendment rights. So I don't think it's going to be any mystery, if you write the story that way, as to whether we think this is something that's unusual and outrageous. I don't think you have to use the kind of language that you're suggesting. And in fact, I don't know that that's terribly helpful.
Well, do you think that there is anything about this moment that calls for any adjustment in tone or focus or aggressiveness on the part of members of the media, or do you think that you make it self-evident by describing in a narrower way the facts of the situation?
Well, there's a lot that's going on in this administration that deserves aggressive coverage. I think we should be aggressive in our coverage. I think we should report more, and report still more, and tell the public what's going on. Those are the kinds of things that have actually elicited a reaction among the public. You know, when you see 19-year-olds and 20-year-olds who are working for Musk, or nominally working for the U.S. government, that when they're, as part of DOGE, when they're getting access to Treasury payment systems, there was, immediate public reaction against that. When you see that that the same group of people are now seeking access to IRS records and all the private information there, as well as Social Security records and all the information that's there, there's a reaction against that. That in itself, that is very powerful. I think we do ourselves a disservice by imagining that good, hard, aggressive reporting doesn't have an impact, and that we have to sort of become like opinion columnists or something like that. So in every story, we can leave that for the opinion pages. We can leave that for commentators of various stripes. But good, hard reporting, that's hard to come by. Everybody has an opinion. That's the cheapest thing in the world. But good, aggressive, revelatory reporting is hugely valuable.
Well, you're getting to something that, to me, seems to be in some cases a hard line to draw. That is the line between opinion and analysis, let's say. And what I struggle with myself is thinking, when you have a set of actions that look plainly, to your judgment, as anti-democratic or unconstitutional or destructive of the rule of law or in the freedom of the press or corrupt, you know, what is the role of normative judgments being stated as matters of fact? Is it a fact to say that Donald Trump is siding with an authoritarian over a Democratic leader in the situation in Ukraine?
Well, I think the reporting has demonstrated that, by the way, is that he is now moving in the direction of suggesting that, or has suggested actually already, and as he has before, as a matter of fact, that Ukraine was somehow responsible for Russia invading it. The reporting says that. He says that. Certainly the line between opinion and analysis can be difficult to draw and difficult to discern sometimes. And that's always been the case. I think, it's important that we be direct in our language. It's important that we be blunt when necessary. But I still believe that there is a difference between opinion about policy and an articulation of the facts.
I think of the debate that many journalists had in newsrooms in the first Trump administration or within themselves over, let's say, whether to use the word lie about something that Trump says, which is not true, or do you say falsehood, or do you say stated without evidence? Are you comfortable with where journalism has landed in terms of that kind of terminology? And are there any others that you would look at and say that's problematic or that's a good thing that the press is adjusted in that way?
Well, not everybody has landed in the same spot, but look, I mean, I think we're much more willing to use the word lie because it's become so clear that he knows that exactly what he's saying is not true. The clearest example of that is the 2020 election. He himself, commissioned consultants of various types to try to prove that the election was fraudulent. And they came back to him and his team and told them that there was no evidence of any significant fraud that influenced the results of that election. And yet he continues to state that. In fact, that he's made that a litmus test for people who are being hired into the administration. So, you know, yeah, we were careful at the beginning. I don't apologize for being careful in the language we use. Once you use a word, you can't take it back. And Trump was a president unlike any we'd ever seen before. And so, you know, and you didn't always know, frankly, whether he was outright lying or whether he was, he didn't know that the facts were, or whether he was just, it was just BS on his part, because he does do a lot of that. He just makes up stuff at the time that whatever serves his particular interests, at the moment. And then he'll say something at times that contradicts exactly what he said before. But there have been many instances since, and there are many instances now, where he knows that what he's saying is absolutely untrue. And if we use the word lie, that's fine. I think, you know, with regard to the phrase without evidence, I think we've fallen back on that maybe too often. And we should just make clear that what he's saying is not true, and that he has no basis for, absolutely no basis for saying that. The clearest example of that is the, you know, the crash between the aircraft at Reagan National Airport, where Trump is, you know, the very next day, without any investigation having been conducted, starts blaming DEI, which is preposterous. No evidence of that, and it's just, he has absolutely no basis for saying that. And I think we can make clear that there's been no investigation conducted yet. And nobody has any idea what exactly happened there.
Do you see anything different that the press might do or ought to do to address the larger issue of disinformation, whether it's coming from Russian propaganda or news outlets that are not fact-based, not reality-based, that are more propaganda or political outlets that have resulted in very large number of Americans believing many things that simply aren't true?
Yeah, well, and it's going to get worse with generative AI as well. We're already seeing it get worse with the dissemination of images, both still images and video images that are being circulated that are just completely fabricated and made to look real. By Gen AI, and audio would be, I would include audio in that as well. Look, it's a really tough thing. I mean, I do think that we as organizations, we need to collaborate. The reality is there's so much disinformation out there that, you know, we need a system among news organizations to really work to address that, and working collaboratively with academic institutions, academic specialists. You know, they tend to not work at the same pace that journalists do, but I think the times call for working a lot faster immediately, really, because so many of these falsehoods are, well, they're disseminated widely to hundreds of millions of people and instantaneously, and they become increasingly difficult to detect and difficult to disprove. And so I think there needs to be a collaborative effort among news organizations and specialists in the world of academia and elsewhere, can work immediately to address serious instances of disinformation.
It is apparent to me that the shifting political environment has affected the behavior of the top levels of American media, by which I mean ownership, whether it's Jeff Bezos, your old boss, who directed that the Post not endorse anyone, or, you know, give a bunch of money to the inauguration at another one of your old papers, the Los Angeles Times. The owner has done similar things. What is your view of what the those who own media organizations, how they've responded to this political moment?
Well, there are a lot of different kinds of owners. I'll just address Bezos because that's the one that I know the best. Look, I've been very incredibly disappointed very upset by what has happened. His decision to kill an endorsement, his decision to run commentary explaining that by essentially seeming to blame the newsroom for lack of public confidence in the media, when the subject is much more complicated than that. The donation to the inauguration via Amazon. The purchase of the rights to Melania Trump's book in order to make a documentary for which she will be the executive producer, paying $40 million, which according to the Wall Street Journal is three times the amount of that was offered by the second highest bidder, being the presence, being on the dais during the inauguration, sitting right behind Trump and in front of the members of the cabinet, you know, that was a disturbing image. You know, Bezos, when he wrote his piece talking about why they didn't endorse for president, he said that all of us need to work harder to establish our credibility and our independence. And that did not look like working harder to establish credibility and independence.
Do you think his behavior was about other business interests beyond that have nothing to do with the Washington Post and its credibility or its viability?
Yeah. I mean, I think that signaled not independence, but dependence. And the dependence comes from all of the contracts that Amazon has with the federal government for cloud computing, and also Bezos's private commercial space venture, Blue Origin, which only recently was able to successfully launch a rocket into orbit and now finally hopes to become competitive with SpaceX in that field. And so they are highly dependent. I mean, Blue Origin is almost entirely dependent on government contracts. And the growth in cloud services for Amazon has come in large part through contracts with the federal government. And I think that he detected that correctly, frankly, that Trump would be more vengeful than he was during his first term. And in fact, he has been. And so I was also disturbed by an interview that Bezos gave to the New York Times during its Deal Book conference, in which he said inexplicably that he thought that Trump had become more calm and settled than he was during his first term. Sadly, the New York Times reporter there did not ask the follow-up question, which would have been, really? How so? Because all the evidence points to the contrary. And he did not, during that interview, to my great disappointment, sort of talk eloquently as he has before, as he did in 2018, as he did in 2016, about the importance of the Washington Post, about the need for an independent media, about its role in the democracy, and about how it's inappropriate for someone who is president or aspires to be president to be threatening the press and the owners of the press.
Well, given the parlous state of economics for our industry, do you think with a couple of exceptions, perhaps the Sulzberger family at the New York Times, our industry is fated to have owners who are going to be in that sort of a dependent relationship with a president like Trump, or is there a route back to the Chandlers and the Grahams and the people who were willing and able to stand up and not go along?
Well, if you know of anybody, please suggest to them that this maybe is a really great time to get into the business. They may not think so, given the financial performance of these businesses, but maybe you can be persuasive. Look, there is no perfect form of ownership. I've learned that over the years. You know, back when we had publicly held companies, everybody was complaining that they were managing their companies only to get the stock price up and to give greater dividends to shareholders, and that they were shortchanging the news organizations and not investing for the long term. And that turned out to be true. We have the owners who have wealthy owners who have other commercial interests. We have corporate owners like Disney and Paramount and now possibly Skynet, which have other commercial interests as well that they worry about. You have private equity, which has turned out to be an hedge fund, which have been turned out to be disastrous, who manage media companies as if they were annuities and they're trying to extract every last penny out of them before they let them die. And then you have nonprofits, which of course a lot of people put their hopes in. But where do nonprofits get most of their money? They get it from the elites too. They get it from the foundations. There's not an unlimited source of philanthropic funding available, frankly. And those are people who have interests as well. And a lot of the foundations have their own sort of interests, because that's what their foundations exist to do. And of course, now you have the administration, which is probably, it seems to be eyeing nonprofits and ways for going after them as well. So there is no perfect form of ownership. It would be great if there were all these public-spirited out people out there who had billions of dollars and they didn't have to worry about the financial performance of these companies. But sadly, that's just not the case.
Well, do you see, as you look at the path ahead for what people refer to as legacy media organizations, is there a viable path? Do you expect to see many more go out of business, or you have a more optimistic take about the industry's ability to figure out how to monetize news gathering?
Well, I always like to remain an optimist. I don't think we can afford not to be optimistic. I think what we do is way too important, important in this society and democracy. And I just don't know anybody who's ever succeeded by expecting to fail. So I remain an optimist. And one reason I remain an optimist is that I've seen so many predictions of failure before that didn't turn out to be true. So let's take the New York Times, by the way, which is doing quite well at the moment. But back in 2009, people were predicting that the New York Times was going to go bankrupt. Its shares had fallen from $50 a share to about $3.50 a share. It needed a loan, a rescue, essentially, from a Mexican billionaire, Carlos Slim. And people were predicting that it would be that the New York Times would be overtaken by Huffington Post and BuzzFeed News. Well, guess what? That didn't happen. They were able to figure out the digital era. They made some very significant and very wise strategic moves. And that's why they're doing as well as they are today. The Washington Post, when I arrived in 2013, there were so many people writing it off. The New York Times columnist, David Carr, wrote a column basically writing off the Washington Post at the time. And look, I mean, we did get a new owner. He did have a new vision. He did invest in it. He did give us our independence, for which I am incredibly grateful, even though I'm disappointed with his what he's done more recently. But I'm incredibly grateful that he did that. And we had six straight years of profitability that nobody at the time, nobody sitting in 2013, anticipated would occur. And at the same time, I see a lot of emerging outlets that have been successful, entrepreneurial outfits, you know, certainly in Washington, you know, with Axios and Punchbowl News and places like that, certainly in the coverage of the tech world, like the information platformer, outfits like that, and some nonprofits at the local level, Spotlight PA in Pennsylvania, that's been able to collaborate with news organizations and raise significant funding. Cal Matters in California, there are a whole range of them that are showing a lot of promise. So yeah, I'm not ready to give up.
One last question. The Trump administration, of course, is like Republicans across the board, has condemned the woke culture, used to be called political correctness, and they've made that a staple of their agenda. One of the things that you pointed out in your book, and others have in writing about, say, the New York Times, is the increasing difficulty for managers to control their own staffs, which I think is bears some relation to what gets called woke sensibility. Do you think that, obviously you've been away from the Post for a couple of years, but did your experience tell you that Trump was onto something about woke culture? And do you see that getting any better within the news business? That is, the ability of managers to make decisions and have the people who work for them go along.
Well, look, I mean, I think it's really important that we have newsrooms that reflect the entirety of our country. People who are from rural areas, people who've served in the military, people who come from evangelical backgrounds. We certainly worked to do that at the Washington Post. We did have people from a whole variety of backgrounds. I do think that in some segments of newsrooms today, There are people who are not working hard enough to try to understand the rest of the country. I mean, our job as journalists is to not just reflect our own life experiences, because our own life experiences are narrow. We can contribute that to the overall knowledge of our newsrooms, and that's really important. But a big mission of journalism is to understand other people and explain one segment of the community and the country to another segment of the community and the country, to serve as an informational bridge. And so, do I think we can do a better job of that? Yeah, I do. And I think that Trump detected that weakness, and that other people have detected that weakness in our newsrooms? Yeah, I think he has, and I think we need to work to do better. I think that there is a greater level of realism today than there was before. I think people are more careful, for example, in their social media posts than they were before, as best I can tell, and they should be. So I think it's our job. Everybody who works within an institution, a media institution, needs to understand that they are a representative of that institution, and that their behavior will reflect on the institution and every single person who works there. And so the people need to exercise care and restraint in their own public pronouncements of one sort or another.
Marty Baron, thanks so much for joining us. Really appreciated the conversation.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to Bedeviled. This podcast is possible because of the DeWitt Wallace Center for Media and Democracy at Duke University. It's produced by Maria Luisa Frasson Nori. Music from Blue Dot Sessions. You can listen to Bedeviled on all podcast platforms.